I don't know whether it's on or off. It's on. Okay. So I thought we would spend the last session of this very brief workshop on questions and answers. But just before that, I'd like to say a few words on a subject which presently is very close to my heart, and I'm sure the heart of all the nuns sitting here, and the monks too, of course. When I was asked by the lamas of my community, of my monastery, to start a nunnery for Himalayan nuns, I then set off basically around the world trying to elicit some interest in the subject of nuns. And this was more than 20 years ago, about 20 years ago now. And basically, the reaction, East and West, was nuns? Oh, yeah, nuns. Oh, you don't hear much about nuns. Lamas talk about monks. Oh, yeah, nuns. Oh. And since that time, in 20 years, now the situation of Himalayan nuns, nuns from Tibet and from the Himalayan regions like Ladakh and Spiti, Bhutan, Nepal, has vastly improved. At that time, they were not educated. They often lived in nunneries which were bore more resemblance to cowsheds or women's prisons than they did to nunneries, and they were generally overlooked. So now, through the efforts of many people, that situation has radically changed. The reason why nuns at that time were overlooked, apart from the social context, was because when the lamas came out from India in the late 50s and early 60s, they, of course, their country had been devastated, their monasteries uprooted, they were very poor, they were refugees. And so they put so much effort into rebuilding their monasteries, reclaiming their traditions, retraining their monks to uphold the Dharma again in India and Nepal. That was 60 years ago. The monks now have magnificent monasteries, are very well trained, are very self-sufficient, basically. The Tibetan refugees, likewise, are, on the whole, doing very, very well. They're building little mini palazzos everywhere, marble bathrooms and all. So, this is good. The Tibetan community has prospered thanks to the kindness of all the thousands of sponsors around the world who were moved by their plight and came forward to help and support and fund. When lamas visited the East or the West, they gave Dharma talks, people made donations, they took the donations back and used them to support their monasteries. Wonderful. However, now I think it is time to to look at another section of the community which has been very overlooked up to now. And that is the situation of these ladies sitting in front of you here, and no doubt the monks too. Do you ever ask yourself, who supports them? How do they get funding? Do you ask? They don't get funding, is the answer. At present in the world, there are hundreds of what we are calling non-Himalayan nuns. This is not, it's a little clumsy, but the fact is that it's including everybody who is not a Himalayan nun, i.e. not a Tibetan or from the Himalayan regions. So it means both Australians, Americans, Europeans, plus all those nuns from Asia, from Taiwan, Singapore, Vietnam, Korea, who, laying aside their own tradition, where they would be supported by the lay people, they join the Tibetan tradition, where they are not supported. So I just want to, I'm not going to go into a big spiel about this, I hope. But I would like to draw your attention to the fact that all these hundreds of nuns are not supported, unlike the Catholic Church, or like Himalayan monks and nuns back in India and Nepal, by the organization. Nobody supports them. They receive ordination, then basically they're on their own. Now, these nuns here, of course, are fortunate because they do have a refuge. They have a place where they can stay. And those who are teachers or in running some kind of director or managers, etc., they do receive a very small stipend. And at least they can work together as a sangha. But many of the nuns in this world, including of this organization, do not have those facilities. They are either completely on their own. I know many nuns who have to go out to work every day. They take off their robes, they have to go to work, come back, in order just to survive. Who's going to keep them? And there are nuns who are running Dharma centers, even here in Australia, who are completely burnt out. They have to supply the rent, pay the taxes, pay the electricity bills, do the teaching, and in general run the whole show themselves. And then maybe they're asked, oh, now you should buy some huge statues and make merit. Oh, you only need about $600,000. These women hardly have enough to eat. Do you know that? When we receive ordination, traditionally it is said to be going forth in faith from home to homelessness. That's the idea. You give up everything. You give up your family, you give up your career, you give up everything for the sake of the Dharma. But traditionally, there's a safety net. There are the lay people. They will take care. They will give you food at least. There's somewhere at least to stay. They will offer robes at the appropriate times. In the Theravadin monasteries, which are full of Western Sangha, the abbot is Western and the monks and nuns are also Western, the lay people make offerings which are used for their Sangha. They are not sent back to Thailand. But when Tibetan teachers come here, whatever offerings they get, They don't give it to the Dharma Center or to the monks or nuns here. They take it back with them. So the Sangha here have no support. You're all busy supporting monks and nuns back in Nepal or in India, most of whom are very, very well taken care of, let me assure you, at this point. So really now is the time to start looking at all these other people. Unlike Himalayan monks and nuns, who basically at this point have really very little to give up. You know, they become monks because it's a life of security. They learn certain, you know, prayers and so forth, and they can support themselves for life. But all the Sangha you see here have given up a lot. Most of them are highly educated. Often they had very successful careers. They didn't have to become monks or nuns. They did so out of faith because they wanted to devote their whole life to practicing and studying Dharma. But so many of them are caught in this trap that they have to spend most of their lives trying to support themselves again. And maybe run Dharma centers. I know so many burned out nuns. They work so hard. And nobody appreciates them. They're overlooked. Because everybody's looking at the Lama. They're not looking at who organizes this event. Who is actually, I mean, the Lamas go around the world. All the Lamas are the same. They all go around the world starting Dharma centers. But they don't support those Dharma centers. They expect the Dharma centers to support them. So this is the situation which has grown up because, you know, of the refugee status of the Tibetans at the beginning. But now the Tibetans are really very prosperous as a community, I assure you. And I think it's time that, you know, people became more aware that the situation for Western Sangha and Asian Sangha, the Western Asia Sangha, has not improved. I have been a nun now for 50 years, and I tell you, it has not improved. Not really. Not enough. So, we have to do something. This is a problem which is not looked at. And really, like any problem, if we don't acknowledge it's a problem, we won't look for a solution. Now we are looking for a solution. A while back in India, we had a meeting earlier this year with about 20 Western nuns and an Indian nun to discuss what to do about this, because all of them were feeling the same, that they're not only are we not financially supported, but also not... They're not trained properly. Here the nuns are lucky because they have geshes and they have a study program, but mostly they're not really trained. You're given robes, you shave your head, you're given a new name, and out you go. Now you're representing Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and you haven't got a clue. And there's no psychological encouragement. There's no appreciation of what these Western Sangha are contributing. How hard they're working for nothing. And then if they get old, they're thrown out. Truly. I met a nun who had worked 20 years in her Dharma center. When she got too old, they told her to leave. That's it. So please think about that, you know? Really think. How are these people being supported? Most of them, yesterday we talked about this last night, and many said how they had to go to work and work and work and work and work to save up enough money in order to be ordained. They had to put it off for years while they saved. I mean, that's not the Buddha's intention. And then they're worried that when their savings finish, what will they do? So I think it's very important. We got together as a group and we discussed, you know, in India what to do. And we decided that we would form an alliance. It's called the Non-Himalayan Nuns Alliance, NHN for short, NHN Alliance, which has various focuses. First of all, to create awareness that people should understand that, you know, these people don't live on air and they do not receive support from their organizations. They're expected. I mean, if they get support, it's very minimal. If they get any at all, it's really not enough to live on. So we wanted to create like a website to let people know, to get stories of these nuns. They are people. I mean, the problem is for Western Sangha is that we're not romantic. We're not exotic. You know, you look at Tibetans. Yeah. Every Tibetan, whoever, you know, I mean, that is really esoteric, man. Wow. A Tibetan. You know, but another Aussie. Blech. You know? And so this lack of appreciation of our own. Because you're not encouraged to look and to recognize the problem. And these monks and nuns are too modest to let you know. They are not going to go and say, hey, by the way, actually I've got nothing to eat, or actually I have no rent. I'd love to come to your center, but I can't afford the fare. But nonetheless, that's their situation. So please think about it. We are trying to raise awareness among all the lay followers. Not saying you don't give donations to the Lama, but also think about your native Sangha. This is the first time in Buddhist history that the native Sangha is not supported by their lay people. Why? Because the lay people are very generously supporting somebody else's Sangha. And not looking at what's right in front of them. We also want to encourage nuns and monks to this is mostly for nuns, but of course monks can do their own thing. The nuns to come together and recognize each other. Many, many nuns, and I'm sure monks too, their main problem is that, you know, apart from a lack of support, is that they feel so lonely, so cut off from a sangha. Here you're very fortunate because you have each other. But many people, they're the only one, maybe in their hometown, you know. And even if they're running a Dharma center, it's lay people with their concerns. Nobody is concerned with the poor nun that's struggling to keep it going and giving teachings. And even when they give offerings, then it's expected to go again over to some nunnery or monastery in Nepal or India. They don't look at what's right in front of them. So we want the nuns to connect also with each other, and then also we want the lamas to understand that now is their opportunity, because, you know, they have done such fantastic work to re-establish their monasteries and their traditions. I mean, they have worked day and night for that, and we know they have. It's not that in any way we are criticizing their activities. It's wonderful what they have done all around the world, and in Nepal, and in Tibet now, in India, everywhere the Dharma is rising again. And these lamas go selflessly around the world, raising interest in their monasteries and in giving such incredibly profound Dharma teaching. Wonderful. But now it's time for them also to look at a little section of the population which has up to now been rather neglected, unintentionally overlooked, is how it's put. They didn't mean to, but, you know, the thing is that Tibetans themselves will say it. I mean, we were talking with a Lama recently, and he said it. Every time a Tibetan sees a foreign face, they think, sponsor. And it doesn't matter if it's a monk or a nun. And it doesn't matter if that monk or nun, a Western monk or nun, is completely penniless. They will assume that because you're Western, you're wealthy. That you have sources of income. And that you should be given to them. It never occurs to them to think to give to you. So we are not expecting to be supported by the Tibetans, but we are hoping that the native Sangha, both in Asia and in the West, will understand that they have a wonderful, wonderful Sangha of their own, right in front of them, that needs help, that needs support, that needs appreciation, encouragement. It can be a very lonely life. They are all living in a non-Buddhist country where every time they go out, people go Hare Krishna or something. I mean, nobody knows what you are. If you're lucky, they'll say Dalai Lama. It's quite lonely. And they need support, not just financial support, but also psychological support, you know, emotional. They need some encouragement and a sense that they're appreciated. All their sacrifices which they have made, their whole life, is somehow appreciated. So I just wanted to say that because I think people are not conscious of the situation. But as I say, it involves hundreds and hundreds of people. And I think it's time that we woke up and recognize there is a problem, but hopefully there will also be a solution. Okay, so now, are there any questions? Not necessarily about this, but about anything. You can't give an example because the experience is beyond thought and therefore beyond words. But basically, it means that normally if we sit and meditate, we're doing something. You know, either we're trying to concentrate on a single object or we're watching the mind or we're watching analytically. And by the way, when we analyze the mind, where is the mind, where is it going, who am I, it's not with words so much as just this big question mark. Because otherwise, if we get caught up in commentaries and arguments and counter-arguments, we're still caught up in the conceptual mind, right? It's the mind talking about the mind. That's not what it means. It means that we really look. But when we are aware of being aware, we're not doing anything. You're just there. And there's just awareness. And we know it. I mean, it's a matter of being conscious, of being conscious. We normally, of course, we're always conscious, but we don't know it because we're so busy thinking. And now we drop the thinking. The thinking is totally ignored. Doesn't matter the thinking is going on in the background. Totally ignored. But we're not focusing the mind on anything. We're just being aware of being aware. It's obvious. And usually one can only do that for a very short time because then, of course, the mind clicks in and starts commenting. But for a short time we can, and then, you know, gradually, of course, the great masters, they can extend it on and on. But for ordinary people like us, we can only do it for a short time before the conceptual mind clicks in again, starts commenting and whatever. But for a few moments, definitely you can. It reminds me, in Bir, in India, near where we live, they have these paragliders. And you see them, you know, up, 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 in this clear blue sky. And it's very like that, you know. There you are. I mean, you know, you're aware. That awareness is a point. But this vast, open spaciousness, silent and quiet and immense. And just the mind just feels very open, but very clear, very vivid. It's very important in meditation that if we find ourselves getting sleepy or heavy or very peaceful but very spaced out, that this is not good. And that if we are really meditating well, then our minds should feel more clear, more crisp, more vivid, but at the same time not tight, very open, spacious. So therefore, when you just sit there and you just are conscious of being conscious. That's all. I mean, there's nothing to do. That's the whole point. Usually the mind wants something to do. Okay, here I'm sitting. Now what shall I do? There's nothing to do. Just be. The rest was so vividly clear, there are no questions. Wow. I think as far as the nature of reality is concerned, they're probably two sides of the same coin. I'm not a scientist, so I can't say. But the kind of space that we're talking about as far as the mind is concerned, as far as the nature of the mind is concerned, is not just an empty space. I mean, it is empty, but at the same time, it has an energy. It has a... The energy part of it, it's very important. It's not just something passive and kind of like, you know, if you talk about the mind as being like the sky, you might get the idea of, as I say, being spaced out. But it's the opposite. It's like being spaced in a way. I mean, like the mind comes vividly awake and clear and vibrant. And that is a kind of energy which is shown in the statues by either their auras or by the flames coming out. It's very energetic. It's by no means just a kind of quiet, you know, sitting and blanking out. It's not blanking out at all. It's coming awake. I mean, then we recognize at that moment of really, really, really... glimpsing the nature of the mind, how much we are asleep. You know, we're dreaming. It might be a pleasant dream or it might be a nightmare, but it really is. It's like when we're asleep and we really believe in our dreams, and then when we wake up, we recognize there's a whole other level of consciousness to being asleep, even though in sleep we might think we're awake now. But when we really wake up, then we recognize it immediately. And so it's like that. Then compared, that you recognize that even our ordinary waking consciousness is still another form of sleep. That's why compassion arises, as I said, because we recognize then that we're all sleepwalking. I mean, how tragic. I mean, it's really very, very sad. You see, you know how much people really, you know, everyone's trying so hard to be happy and so often doing exactly the things which are going to cause trouble. And they cause trouble for themselves, they cause trouble for others. We are so deluded. And the tragedy is that we don't need to be deluded. Because our inherent nature is completely awake. How is it that we got stuck in this spiral of ignorance and grasping and clinging that causes so much pain to ourselves and others? That's why, as the great masters, when, you know, their minds become so vast, at the same time their hearts just open up totally, effortlessly. And then from that comes the energy of their Buddha activity, which again, you know, is something which just manifests in answer to the need of other beings. You see it in, when you meet really great masters, as you know. You know it's effortless. They just naturally, spontaneously, they have no choice, really. You've got to do it. It just comes. That's why being in their presence is so inspiring. And even if they don't do anything, like when the first masters came out from Tibet, you know, they didn't know English, they didn't know anything, and they just sat there. But they didn't have to do anything. You just knew in their presence that this was the fulfillment of our human potential. And that what, I mean, many, many people said that when they went to meet the very great lamas when they first came out, their initial response was, well, I don't know what you believe, but whatever it is, I'll go for it. I mean, like with Lama Yishe also, you know, I mean, all these drugged out hippies, you know, up the hill to Copan where they'd collapse at his feet. And he recognized their potential. He was one of the first lamas to really recognize the potential of all these weird-looking Indians. I mean, they were weird-looking in those days because they were all hippies, right, in Nepal. And instead of saying, my God, I don't want anything to do with this weird-looking lot, and especially I don't want other lamas to see me with this weird-looking lot, he completely opened his heart and his arms to them all and really taught them with so much love and an appreciation of their potential that he knew they could do it. And so this kind of quality wasn't that he was trying, it just naturally came from the clarity of his own vision that he could see their Buddha potential. We all have Buddha potential. Even a mosquito has Buddha potential. Take them a bit of time, but they've got it. Not as much time as you might think. I mean, for example, the previous Karmapa loved birds, and especially finches, which is a very ordinary-looking little brown bird of no particular qualities, you would think, but he loved them. And when his finches died, they stayed in Tukdom. They stayed on their perches. Lucky little finches. So all beings have that potential, not just human beings, but human beings usually have the opportunity to get closer. Most animals don't have that opportunity. But, you know, for example, in India or Nepal, if you took your pet dog to a wong, to an empowerment, then as the lamas come around, you know, bonking everybody on the head, they were always also given the empowerment to the dog. And whatever sacred substances, they will make sure the dog eats it too. Because they recognize this dog has potential. There's some reason why the dog had the opportunity to come to this wong, and therefore it must be treated the same as everyone else. So, you know, if even dogs and finches have Buddha potential, what to speak of us who have this very precious human birth? The important thing then is not to waste it, but really use it. So that at the time of death, whenever that may be, shorter or longer, who knows? Nobody knows. We can die without regrets, thinking, well, you know, on the whole, I use this human birth to benefit myself, to benefit others. I didn't waste it. Well, if we can get that far, that's already, you know, most people, if we look around, are really wasting their opportunity. And if we waste it, it probably won't come again, not for a long, long time. So please, the important thing is to take the Dharma and use it in your daily life, not to think that Dharma is something, as I said right at the beginning, that we do when we go to Dharma centers, when we read books, when lamas come, that's Dharma practice. Rest of the time with my family, at my work, with a social life, that's so much worldly activity. If we think like that, nothing ever is going to move. We have to integrate the Dharma with our daily life. This is why mostly I don't talk much on meditation. I give a lot of talks on Lojong, on this mind training for taking everything onto the path, because I think it's very important. It's very practical. You know, everybody can take that into their lives. The idea that when we meet with difficult circumstances, rather than being upset, being angry, being defeated, we can use that to generate great strength, patience, understanding, compassion, and really take it on the path so that whatever happens to us, whatever happens, good things, difficult things, everything, what can I learn from this? How can I use this on the path? How can I use this? What can I do with it? It's very important that we recognize that everything which we meet on in our daily life is our opportunity. Everyone we meet is our opportunity for practice. Otherwise, days go by and nothing, you know, nothing moves. Really, it's very important to look on our daily life as our practice, all of it, not just the bits where you're, you know, formally practicing, but the whole of it. How to open the heart, how to become more centered, how to develop these qualities which are needed. You know, I mean, the paramitas alone is generosity, ethics, patience, enthusiasm and effort, as well as meditation and wisdom. Meditation and wisdom are just the end bits. I mean, what about the rest of it? How can we learn patience if nobody ever annoys us? I mean, just that. How can we learn compassion if we ourselves don't know suffering? So, once we recognize that everything we do, I mean, just your family, the people you live with, are we making them happier? Probably we are taking them for granted. So we shouldn't take them for granted. We should really make an effort to make them that bit happier. Sometimes people complain, I mean, in the West, that, you know, their family or their parents and so forth, or their partner doesn't like the fact that they are Buddhist and how to convert them to the true path. And the only way we convert anybody to the true path is through our own conduct, not through words. But if we appear to be happier, and kinder and more thoughtful and considerate of others, then your family is going to say, I don't know about this Buddhism, but you seem ever so much nicer nowadays. And then they will, you know, if they see you're nicer, then they will be interested. Why are you nicer? Atisha said, if we do even a year's retreat, but at the end, the only question we have to ask ourselves is not what experiences we got, what realizations and insights. What we have to ask ourselves is, are our negative emotions, our greed, our anger, our pride, envy, all the negative emotions in our mind, have they lessened? stayed the same or increased. Because sometimes people do meditation and they come out and then they get more irascible, more irritated, more sensitive to their feelings. So he said, if your negative emotions, your afflictive emotions have not gotten less, if they've gotten increased or stayed the same, it was a waste of time. The criteria is the mind becoming tamed? Are we dwelling more in thoughts of kindness, compassion, care for others, calm, more concentrated, more at the same time, more spacious and inclusive? Is our mind in fact improving or not improving? Is our heart opening or not opening? All this other stuff doesn't matter. As the Dalai Lama says, he says, my religion is kindness. So all of us can, in order to be kind, you need someone to be kind to. So all those people out there, the lovely ones and the difficult ones, all of them can be the object for our kindness, for our learning how to develop that state of mind which wishes well for everybody. Otherwise, what's the point? You know, we learn all these high philosophies and we learn all these complicated visualizations, and at the end of the day, what use is it? If we are not, you know, we are not kinder and we're not nicer and we don't care that much about other people, and inside we're also feeling miserable, then what's the point? So again, I would say, you know, our mantra is letting go. If we really want to practice Dharma, we have to simplify also. We have to simplify our lives. We have to be very careful. The most precious object which we have is our mind. And really think about the fact, you know, when we have our house, our apartment, our room, we keep it clean. We clean it. We decorate it nicely. We make it a nice, comfortable, pleasant place for us to live in. Isn't it? How much time and effort people spend on their houses and their apartments, their room. And then our bodies. Nowadays, especially, everyone's very sensitive to what they eat or don't eat, especially what they don't eat. We take showers every day. We put on clean clothes. We spend a lot of time, you know, selecting what we're going to wear. We think about our hair, our faces. You know, spas have become the big thing nowadays. We're so careful to take care of our physical bodies. But actually, where we live, not in our apartment, not in our bodies, but in our minds. And how much care do we take to keep them clean, swept out, well aired, beautifully decorated with fine thoughts? That's where we live. But so often, thanks to the media, we just mostly bring in piles of junk and trash, and it just sits there. No wonder people get depressed. You just have to turn on the television and you understand why people get depressed. So we should be selective. We should prioritize what we are going to put in our mind. Not just take in anything, because we take it in, we don't know how to get rid of it again. We don't understand its empty nature, so it just sits there like rotting junk. And then, you know, it's very difficult to build a Buddha palace on top of a trash heap. You know, we need to clear out, get some space in there. Really be really more careful what we allow into our mind, because it sits there and we think about it and then we worry and it aggravates. So we have to make choices. What are we going to watch? What are we going to listen to? What are we going to read? Who are we going to befriend? Because also the Buddha said that it's very important the company we keep. I mean, obviously we're going to be friends with everybody on one level, but on another level we should be careful to, as much as possible, find good friends. The Buddha always praised good companionship. And so we need to support each other. It doesn't just mean hanging out with a Buddhist crowd. It means finding people with good values, finding people with good hearts. Doesn't matter what religion they are or no religion. That's not the important thing at all. What is important is that we should share a common sense of human worth. And that they should be people whose company inspires us and reminds us of our journey, not who just distract us with endless petty affairs of the world always. So each one, and those of you who are parents, please, please, children learn by example. So merely lecturing them is not going to get you anywhere. They don't care what you say. They look at what you do. So if you want your children to have good principles and to be kind and to think of others and to be considerate, then you have to do that first. And take the children with you while you're doing it. So they get the example. So they understand what is to be done. And it's very hard bringing up children in this day and age. We all know. The amount of distractions there are formidable. And this is why all the more we ourselves should set the example. It's no good telling children they can't look at computers and iPads if you yourself are always on your computer and iPad or endlessly sending text messages. And then say, don't you dare look at your iPhone. You know, I mean, how can you say not when you're doing the same thing yourself? So we should guard our mind throughout the day, really being aware of what we are thinking, where our mind is dwelling habitually, what kind of thought patterns. And if they are negative, then we should make efforts to change and transform them. If they are positive, then we encourage them. But we have to be conscious of what we are doing, conscious of what we are saying, and especially conscious of what we are thinking. And then open the heart to recognize that all beings we meet, whoever they are, want to be happy and do not want to be sad. So whether they are easy people or difficult people, we wish them well. It's not so difficult. None of this is difficult. The main problem is we don't do it. We are caught in our habits. This is our problem. And as neuroscientists know, you know, the reactions will go along the broad highway of our habitual tendencies. We just go that way. Somebody annoys us, we get irritated because we always did get irritated and we never tried to stop it. So that makes a very broad neural pathway. But it's not our inherent nature. It's just something which we have learned, either this lifetime, last past lifetimes. But anyway, the thing is that it can be changed. And this is the important thing for now, is that, you know, neuroscientists, even though they're so obsessed with the brain, still they have shown that these neural pathways can be changed. And fairly rapidly, if we really, you know, keep going in make a determination to go in a different direction, then like any pathway, after a bit, the old pathway starts to get grass and overgrown, and a new pathway gets broader and more smooth. So if we naturally get very irritated by other people when they don't do what I want, then we make the determination to really send loving kindness to ourselves. Often people get irritated with other people because they're irritated with themselves. So we have to start with working on ourselves so we feel at home within ourselves. If we feel at home within ourselves, it's easier to feel much more tolerant of others. But the thing is, by doing loving kindness and compassion meditations over and over and over and over, we retrain our neural pathways. I mean, it's been proved. And it doesn't take forever. It just takes determination. Because all these negative emotions which we have are not inherent. They are learned patterns of response, which are negative learned patterns of response. And because they're learned, we can unlearn. Whereas our compassion and our loving kindness and our clarity is part of our inherent nature. So it's something much deeper within us. And every time we respond positively, we are invoking the deepest part of our true nature. So somebody said that she was a therapist, and she said that people are always saying, oh, but I can't change. Being angry is second nature to me. And she said, that's great. That's your second nature. But what about your first nature? And so please always remember our first nature is perfect. Our first nature is Buddha. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, that's amazing. Sonam niya tam jese ba ni to ni ne ba ra na bam se ne je ka na je ba la tu ba yi se fi su le dwa dwa shu jam ba pa o je ta jam ba dang kun tu sam bo de an de jin de de ra kun ji je wa kun su o de da tam chi ra tu ngo. I'm worn out, I have to say. Chancho Sancho Rinpo Che Ma Che Pa Nam Che 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 Wa Nyam Pa Me Pa Yang Go Ne Gong Do Pe Wa Shu. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you everyone for coming, and on behalf of Chanrasik Institute and I think everyone here in the Gompa today, I would like to thank Jetsuma very, very much for coming and for giving these really precious teachings. I hope you found it as inspiring and motivating as I did. And we would like to make an offering to Chetsuma and also a donation towards her project, the Non-Himalayan Nuns Alliance, which you contributed to by coming today. It's sponsored by the proceeds of the ticket sales. And on behalf of our Sangha and also all lay students, we would like to make a request to Chetsuma to please come back to Trans Jurassic Institute soon. Maybe next time for a little bit longer, something like a month-long shamatha retreat, perhaps. We would certainly love to have you back. And last but not least, I would like to say thank you to you all. By coming here, actually, you help the non-Himalayan nuns and monks twice, once through giving money to Chetsuma's project, but also by coming here, engaging in our teachings, eating here, shopping here, you actually help us keeping this center running, and through this we can give our Sangha a home. So thank you very much, and I hope to see you again. And now it's time for you, if you would like to make offerings to Chetsuma, please come forward.
Okay, so sorry. One announcement I have to make. Good God, I'm the president. I should remember. there is this international women's Buddhist women's organization called Sakyadita. Sakya, as in the Buddha Sakyamuni. Dita, meaning daughter. D-H-I-T-A, Sakyadita. And this is a Buddhist organization for women. Of course, men are very welcome, but the emphasis is on women, and we meet every 2 years in a different Buddhist country. So they started off in Bodh Gaya, and then they've been to Lumbini and Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, Thailand several times, Sri Lanka, India again, Vaishali last time, and so forth. And it's for nuns and lay women, of course. And everybody comes together. It's totally non-sectarian. There's no high or low. Everybody participates together. It's really a very beautiful event. Every morning, a different nun from a different tradition, from Thailand, Sri Lanka, Tibet, Korea, Taiwan, whatever, leads the meditation. The different nuns chant in their own languages. There are many, many talks by scholars and practitioners and workshops, many workshops, all of it directed to what is of interest for Buddhist women. Any of you who have ever attended a Buddhist conference will know how much women normally are very much in the minority. And many of the subjects are not really directly affecting us and our participation in the Dharma. So this conference is specifically for women, Buddhist women throughout the world. And the next conference will be held from June 23rd to June 30th, with then a 2 or 3 day pilgrimage in Indonesia. This is why I'm mentioning it, because Indonesia is not so far, and we will be staying at a kind of resort next to Borobudur. And so part of the pilgrimage would definitely be to Borobudur, as well as to other... You know, Indonesia used to be a great Buddhist country. And, of course, Paldanatisha went there, and there are many, many Buddhist remains still there. And the Indonesians themselves, although now, you know, the majority are Muslim, are nonetheless very sympathetic to their Buddhist heritage. And but also there are lots and lots of Indonesian Buddhists there, not only among the Chinese, but also among the indigenous people. And so I please invite you all to go to the Sakyadita website, Sakyadhita, and look up all about us, and really think about coming and supporting this conference. It's great fun, honestly, I assure you. It's beautiful, and you meet such interesting people from all around the world. Okay, sorry.
It's up to you, whatever you'd like to do with it. We just, if we can have a copy, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, but entirely up to you what you'd like to do. I'm missing two. No, no, it's okay, keep going. I'll just keep taking photos while you're talking. Yeah, yeah. yes, if someone can start to bring but the bag of iron might not be zipped up. Maybe leave my bag and I'll take it. But if someone's going to come down. Thank you. Just for you, anybody else?
So everything that we collect now we will give for the non-Himalayan Nuns Alliance. We need to start with a little pool, you know, and then work out how we can best use it, the funding that we get. So everything which you offer will be used for that now.
I will be talking to her. I'll be talking to her in a few days.
apart from that. I'll give them to Woody the envelope.